Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Double Shelix. I'm Kayla.
And I'm Sally.
We're very excited to have our guest, Dr. Shirley Malcolm. Dr. Malcolm is director at Sea Change Initiative at AAS, and she's working to improve the quality and increase education access and careers in STEM fields. I could talk for a long time about all her experience and her many accolades, so I'm just going to give a few highlights. She's a former member of the National Science Board. She's been on the policymaking body for the Clinton administration. She has 16 honorary degrees. She won the Public Welfare Medal of the National Academy of Sciences in 2003. She has a PhD in ecology from Penn State University. All this to say, she is very qualified to talk about what we're going to be discussing today. And that is why we're so excited to have her. So today we're going to talk about, can trainee salaries sustain science? I think if you're tuning in today, it's probably not a secret to you that there is a problem in this space, which is that trainee salaries are not competitive. We're going to dive into why this is a problem, what it means, and what are we going to do about it. So let's get started. Why is low pay for trainees a problem?
Where do I start? I think that one of the things that I need to say is that the salary issue is only one of the issues. The bigger issue is the whole question of training and the place of graduate students and postdocs within the scientific enterprise. Okay, let's be honest. Somebody who is a senior PI is probably not going to be at the bench. They're going to be someplace giving a speech, writing a paper, doing paperwork, doing compliance, writing the next proposal or something. But the people who actually, in many cases, who are there carrying out this work, they're the graduate students and the postdocs. This is traditional. I mean, the idea of situating research within universities is an old idea. I mean, it's reflected in Vannevar Bush's works, his report, Science, the Endless Frontier. And he talks about putting the research function in the university because you actually accomplish two things at the same time. That is that you get the research done, but you also train the next generation of researchers. And you have a mechanism then to always have a refresh. You're bringing up the next generation. You are ensuring that ideas are coming in from young people who don't know that something is impossible. So there's always this kind of refresh of the enterprise. Now, that sounds like a good idea, and I actually think that it is a good idea. Places that have done it differently, for example, in Europe, where they have research institutes that may be separate from the actual higher education part of the work, they're moving more toward our strategy. They have over time moved more toward our strategy. So what's wrong? What has happened? I think that in many cases, when research was being funded by agencies, there was this idea of let's get more research, but not a deep analysis of the human consequences of doing research the way we've always done it, which is to bring in apprentices, younger people, to actually do the work of the research. And in so many cases, they have not, in fact, paid attention to creating a policy environment that is attentive to what happens to the people, okay? The people who commit to doing that research as a way of contributing, learning, establishing themselves in a career, they become quote-unquote byproducts of the research, not as the products of the research. A paper that you write, I mean, basically, today, in 10 years, it could be obsolete because the knowledge moves on. But when you are investing in this next generation of people, they continue to grow and evolve, and they're the real legacy of this work. So I say all of this to emphasize that we have a system, but we haven't necessarily queried that system or paid attention to what happens to the people who are caught and who are part of that system. So, what does that mean? It means that you can still be paying salaries, which might have been okay 10 years ago, but the world has moved on. That's number one. But number two, we tend not to have the kinds of policy discussions that we need to, that focus in on not just how people are being treated within those environments, because that is a major part, not just pay, but respect and learning and the kinds and nurturing and mentoring, those other kinds of things that are supposed to be going on at the same time, which is the reason that you put the research in these places in the first place. Those are important questions to have to explore as well. And I don't find a lot of exploration of those questions. And so that, while the salary issue may be a more visible indicator that we have a problem, it is not the only indicator that there are things that need to be looked at within the system.
Yeah, and I think that really resonates with many grad students and postdocs experience where you might be told like it's okay to earn only, let's say between $30,000 and $40,000 as a graduate student per year if you're lucky, because you're receiving this training, because you're receiving this mentorship and this degree that's really going to set you on this path towards success in the future. But what I'm hearing and from you and in our experience, like that training and that mentorship is often a second priority or a third or fourth priority to that power structure where the PI needs to get grants, they need to do all the other things, they're teaching undergrads. Like, where do you fall? And the answer is between the cracks.
That's it exactly. And that's one of the things too, that it has been the case, especially with the doubling of the budget at the NIH, that there was a wild expansion of the people, because if you're going to double the budget, people got to get more research done, which means I'll take more graduate students, more postdocs, more whatever, rather than thinking through, well, maybe I need to rethink the way that I people this work. Maybe I need to hire research professors or research associates or something else rather than postdocs or graduate students, and that's the way that I get this work done. I am afraid to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, that people have maintained that structure because it worked for them. They were
Yes.
often a product of that structure, but the low salaries that you might give to a postdoc or to a graduate student, you can't give that to a person who is a regular hire as a research associate. And so that means that you're being incentivized to undercut the enterprise. And that to me is a real problem. I have a real problem with that. There is nothing about that that is fair. And so I want us to explore the system as a system, and to look at the incentive and disincentive structures that are sitting there. I mean, yes, it's great to say to somebody, I'm preparing you to take on your own lab. Not,
There aren't enough labs to go
there
around.
are not enough labs to go around. That's it exactly. But in addition to that, let's talk about some other problems. Why are you only preparing somebody to be you, like you? There are lots of exciting opportunities. I mean, look at me. I'm sitting here. I'm sitting here needing to retire, but I'm sitting here as a person who only served as a faculty member for a very short period of time. And I think I have been able to carve out a successful career doing something different, being someone who would support the enterprise through professional societies, through my work in policy, And there are people who will look at this and be able to carve out careers in journalism, carve out careers in editing, carve out careers in as authors, in industry, as lots of different things. And there are lots of different opportunities. But your senior PI isn't necessarily incentivized to show you what those opportunities are, or they're not necessarily experienced around those other options to be able to show you those other options. In addition to that, let's be really, really honest. You know, most people with STEM degrees don't work in STEM. That's number one. They don't necessarily take on these academic positions. But the other thing is that you talk about the incentives and so on. When we passed legislation and policies were put in place that did not have mandatory retirement, and obviously I'm old enough that I'm not a big fan of mandatory retirement, but I am a fan of people being encouraged to move into other roles. But at that point, a lot of things got locked into place. And that is that you didn't have to retire at 70 or whatever the age was. And so you could remain as a senior PI for years and years and years and years more. And the kind of natural turnover that might bring younger people into that didn't happen. The other thing is that the young investigators are, let's be honest, they're competing against with the senior investigators for the grants. And so and in many cases, when they come up on a kind of a head-to-head basis, sometimes they have carve-outs for early career people. But if they come up on a head-to-head basis, you're going to advantage the senior person, or you're going to basically give them the benefit of the doubt. They've done this for years. They know how to do it. I'm looking for a reason to cut somebody from the herd. This person left this particular piece out. It may be a different idea, a more exciting idea, new pathway, etc. But the structures are just so set up like concrete that it's very difficult to perturb them in ways that are really needed in order to make sure that we can maintain the energy, the innovation that is available to us within research. Another part that I'm going to be speaking the unspeakable, but I'm going to say it anyway. The other part is that the senior members of within the science community do not look like the early career people. You have much more diversity. You have many more women, you have more people of color among the younger people. So you'll never be able to really get turnover, even within faculty, if those people cannot have some success early on and be able to move into faculty positions. I have friends who would tell me about the good old days. They are my age or a little bit younger. And they would tell me about the good old days when they got their first NIH grant and they were in their late 20s, for sure in their 30s. Okay. But now when you're talking about people being in their 40s before they get their first, and I'm like, okay, what are they doing in the interim? And unfortunately, the story has been they are serving in multiple postdoctoral positions. It's like a holding pattern. You know, that they are expected to circle O'Hare forever, I guess, before they can land. And I think that all of these things need conversation. We need discussion. We need to be honest that in many of the cases, the way that agencies work, in fact, perpetuates this particular cycle in ways that are just not good for the enterprise.
I couldn't agree more. Also, I'm sitting here watching the holding pattern story in real time with many, many of my peers. And I think I'll just add to that that one of the challenges of being stuck in that holding pattern is that as a postdoc, you're still not really even training in what a PI is doing.
That is true. That is absolutely true. I mean, you're not getting the opportunity to experience the higher level work that may come with taking on a senior level role.
Exactly.
So if the presumably a postdoc still has an element of training and coaching and mentoring that is associated with it. So how intentional is that? Are you just assumed that because you're in the room that you will inhale it? I mean, or is it in fact something that is taught, that in fact that you spend time talking about what those roles happen to be, that there is honest discussion about the kind of the framing, the what do I use this for, where do I go with this, how much conversation about startups and companies that you might spin off? I mean, because that is another option. So there are all these other options, but as I said before, where do you learn about? Okay, and how do you, in fact, opt into these other possibilities? So that's kind of the real challenge that I have. And that's just on the professional side. You want to go over to the personal side?
Oh, we do.
I mean, we can go over there. And I do think that we do need to go over there and have a conversation. As I said, this is a very different population than 20 years ago. The women who are part of that population are saying, okay, now if I want to start a family formation, now where does that fit into this timeline? All right. And in many cases, the people who are around you think that if you want to stop out and have a family, or you want to move to something other than full time, or you want to do more remote things that are happening every day now because of the pandemic. But the point is that oftentimes people who do that are considered not serious. What does serious look like when you basically devote your life to trying to be able to contribute on the one hand and realize that you're having to do all these other things, that it's like spouse, partner, children, dogs, I mean, parents, siblings, it's like all of this other stuff that you've got to somehow deal with. Rent, mortgage, car, or not. But I mean, it's all sitting there and it all has to be dealt with.
And it relates back to money, right? Like when you were talking about, you know, having a family, like both Kayla and I had a child in our final year of grad school. We made about $37,000 a year, and we went to the only available daycare near campus, and it cost $2,300 a month. So like you do the math on that. Like it was brutal.
Yeah, but I'm afraid that a lot of people are not doing the math on that.
Exactly. So like it was a tough decision, and a lot of people do the math and say, it's not worth it. I'm going to put that on hold. I'm going to put my life on hold for this career that is within a system that is not built for me. And it's not built for people like me. And I don't see people like me at the top. So why stay?
I have heard multiple people say, I'm tired of putting my life on hold. So either you are able to stay in because you have some kind of money privilege, you have a partner that is earning more money or something like this, or you put your life on hold, or you leave.
Or you basically try to do it all and just run yourself into the ground. There is that as well. So, I mean, a lot of people, you know, they have, even like in graduate school, they had a safety net from their folks. We say we want to diversify the faculty and the research community. Many of those people are coming from low-income families. Many of those people that we want to attract into our science are coming from poor and minoritized populations. They're basically having a problem in a lot of cases just even having their families understand why they are still in school. Now, I got that question, and I don't know if other people got that question, after having finished the 4 years, when you are presumably capable of going out and getting a job that will bring income in, you're still in school. And I, my Uncle Jerry just could not understand it for the life of him why I was still in school. Fortunately, my parents were basically like, you don't have any stake in this. You don't have any investment in this. So it's good with us. But the point is, there's all of this peace that encompasses this unspoken narrative over here about what's going on within science. So that's the reason, after coming back from one of my trips and seeing who was actually doing the work and knowing that they were living in places that they could not afford to live in, or bunking in with 12 other people, that in fact, that I said to Sudip, we've got to write about this. We've got to. We can't not speak.
Yeah. And this is referring to your recent science article with the headline, "Students and Postdocs Deserve More." And I feel like that could have been amended to like more money, more power, more opportunity, more respect, like across the board.
We left it open. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's
the
a good
money
headline.
It wasn't just about the money. Yes, it's about the money. But it wasn't just about the money. You know, it was about the fact that you don't always, your contributions are not always appreciated, respected, acknowledged, or even get your names on papers. You know, I mean, I have seen in too many cases where people appear in the acknowledgments, but not among the authors. And I am like, okay, what didn't they do to get their name up top? What did they do to get their name down at the bottom? And so I went and visited my former colleagues at the National Science Board one time, and we were talking about sea change, which in the process of self-assessment, we ask institutions about all these kinds of issues in terms of postdocs and graduate students and what's happening with those members of the community. So in my comments to my colleague, to my former, the people with whom I would formally connect, members of the science board, I said, don't you realize that you're not just funding research, you're funding the environment in which research is being done.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that there is enough appreciation but the fact that you are funding the environment in which research is being done. However that looks, if it is a healthy environment, if it's an inclusive environment, or if it's a toxic environment. And we know, for example, from the studies and the work that was done by the national academies around sexual harassment, sexual gender harassment, that it is not always a happy situation. The unequal power dynamics that appear within these laboratories, the dependence on a senior person for their support. I mean, there's lots of things that are wrong with the power dynamics and power relationships that get exploited and that can be exploited under these kinds of circumstances. And that's part of the more that we're talking about, more respect, more attention, not just about the money, but yes, about the money.
And it seems that, you know, you have this huge power hierarchy, which also puts the trainee who is now there longer and longer and not necessarily getting the training that they signed up for or that they thought that they were going to get for the job that they would think they were going to get, puts them in a very vulnerable situation where now a single person can completely destroy their career. And then the final push on this is the money, because now they're also financially vulnerable and in a precarious situation, potentially, not to mention that you've already eliminated people who can't afford to be trained. who can't
That's
afford
absolutely true.
to stay there.
Yeah, and I think that, as I said, we want to start a conversation about this, not just among the graduate students and the postdocs. I have had an opportunity to speak to the research VPs at the Association of American Universities. I will be speaking to research VPs in another month at a different convening. I try to speak to these issues in the context of agency policies. I am a co-vice chair of the something called the Society's Consortium on Sexual Harassment and STEM, going at that issue as an issue and trying to say what can professional societies do to begin to remove some of the structures that keep all of that in place. I don't know if you remember the report. It says that that harassment remains within a system because the system is tolerant of harassment. And what we're trying to do is to make it intolerant of harassment and to put it into a situation where there are some kind of loss of a privilege that is related to bad behavior.
Yeah. And I think, so that's one of the solutions that you guys are working on, like basically not giving money to toxic mentors. But, or are there additional kind of work streams that you're thinking about in terms of how we can push the systemic factors in a better direction, whether they are realistic policies or things that you would just love to wave a magic wand?
Oh, I do magic wands well. The thing is that with sea change, these questions are an embedded part. They ask about the policies and practices and culture. And they ask this at the university, the institution level. That's not the best place to ask it. The best place to ask it is at the departmental level. And we are working with some other professional societies in standing up discipline level sea change structures so that we can do top down and bottom up at the same time. The group that is furthest along is physics and astronomy. They brought together a collaborative of physics professional societies and astronomy society. And they are creating a framework that works for their fields, because that's the other thing, you know, not every field's the same in terms of where the opportunities are to make change. So they are looking at that, and I think that is a great idea if we can end up standing up all of these for all of the different disciplinary areas or life sciences as opposed to individual fields or engineering as opposed to individual fields, although there are individual field differences among engineering and among the life sciences. The point is that we can't just sit here, all right? We've got to do something. So in our case, as AAAS, as a professional society, we have the ability to stand up something like Sea Change. We want Sea Change to become like this badge of recognition for those who are striving to do better, all right? And so we want people to begin to make decisions about where they want to go to school or where they want to work based on having or not having these kinds of recognitions that, in fact, say these institutions have gone through processes to try to figure out where they are so that they can make change, so that they can go to a better place. And that once that they make those changes, they begin to make the changes, that they are likely to have greater productivity, greater retention, greater, more innovation. The people in a happy place do more work.
And more creative work.
They are more creative. They can, because they're not basically being burdened with all of these other kinds of thoughts about how they're going to make ends meet or how they're going to dodge this harasser. I mean, so I think that those are kind of particular aspects. But I don't want us to just think that it's about external forces, because the agencies do need to act, and they do need to start making moves that can repair some of the damage that is out there. They need to do it in a way that is systematic and coordinated. Okay. But in the meantime, what I want, the magic wand moment, what I want is I want people to take their lives back as individuals. If these people are unwilling to give you what you need, find what you need somewhere else. And I give you an example, and that is that if you haven't had an opportunity to provide instruction, to teach, okay, if there are lots of teaching jobs, unfortunately, many of them are contingent faculty when you're talking about colleges or community colleges or what have you. So it's not a lot of money that would be pulled in, but experience will be pulled in. And your ability to help people understand that you can do this work well makes you more marketable for different types of institutions. Okay. I say this because many people want to go to the same types of institutions that they're in, but there are other institutions that are out there that are looking for great faculty, including offering opportunities for faculty to be able to do research. If you look at my bio sketch, you see, yes, I'm a trustee at Caltech, and you can't probably get more, you know, researchy than Caltech, but I'm a regent at Morgan State University. Morgan State University is an historically Black university that is based in Baltimore, not that far from Hopkins, not that far from a lot of places. Morgan is an R2, it's a research two institution that aspires to ascend to an R1 so that it can put the research capacity in place to be able to address the needs of the Black community that it sits sitting in. Okay, so Morgan is going to be looking for people who have research experience and who can help to build their research capacity. And they've gotten recent centers funded by the state, which means that they have faculty lines that they're going to have to fill with people who are tenurable, people who can come in and build research programs that speak to the needs of the community. Now, people might prefer to, they might want to go to Hopkins rather than to Morgan, but Morgan has the lines and Morgan has the interest and Morgan has the need and the desire to build research capacity while not ignoring the needs of the students that are coming to them. I think I'd rather be in a place like that than one that is hyper-competitive and is basically expecting that I turn water into wine regularly. So I do think that maybe different search methods, really different, really kind of reconfiguring one's search criteria, looking and thinking differently about what might be out there. There are people who are needed as editors, for example, of journals, not like top editors, but field editors on journals. The federal government needs people that they can hire as program officers. I mean, so there's other places that people can go and other things that they could think about doing. And taking one's life back in many cases means rethinking what it is that you want to accomplish and whether you can only accomplish that in the places where you have been looking or whether you have been overlooking places where you can accomplish your goals.
Yeah, and I resonate with that. And I think part of what this ties back to what we were talking to earlier, like not only does the current academic training system not fully prepare you to be an academic because there's so much of a difference between when you're a postdoc and when you're a PI, the current academic training system also, unless you go out and seek these opportunities, isn't training you for the skills you'd need to be an editor, a program officer, R&D researcher in industry.
That's it exactly. That's it exactly. And so you may have to like go into an internship role that would have been unthinkable, you know, in the past. When I left my faculty role and moved to Washington when I married, I went to work at AAAS because that was a job that really interested me. They were looking at developing an inventory of programs that had been undertaken to bring minorities into the sciences, engineering, mathematics, and biomedicine.
Yeah. That initial transition from going from a professor role to an RA role really sets you up for a full career with decades of experience thinking about these like DEI issues that for most people have only been front of mind for like 5 years.
I know. I've basically been working on these issues for 45 years. So yes, that's it exactly. It is, sometimes you got to go down to go up. You have to have somebody around that you could talk to about these things. And that's the part that troubles me. And that is that sometimes when you want to have these conversations, people want to label you a failure, and you're not. You are basically a learner, a striver. You are trying to create something that does not exist. And that means that you can't necessarily just start in that role. You've got to build that role.
I like the idea of being a learner and not a failure. I want to circle back to your comment on departments being a good place to make change. And we just made an episode about department culture and how to change departmental culture. And I'm wondering, do you see departments also as the prime candidate for making change in terms of pay structure? Or is that something that individual PIs should be doing, or funding agencies? And I'm, you know, asking for a future me, wondering how I'm going to pay my trainees and take care of them.
Okay, well, let me just say this. This is not an either or, this is an and both. And the reason that I say this is that departments are held captive to the desires and aspirations of whole institutions. And so you can't just change one without really affecting, without changing the other. That's the place where you live. I mean, that's the place where the misery is most proximate, but it is still, it's not the only place that has where you have to make adjustments. You know, I have been advocating to funders, and this is to private philanthropy, and I've said, you know, you need to start asking questions about what's going on in the department before you put your money in there.
Yes. Thank you. That's so important.
Okay. Yes. All right. Who is there? How much, in what role do they have? What do you pay them? What is going, you need much more information. Otherwise, you are basically putting your money into toxic and unhealthy places. And I guarantee you, you're not getting good return on investment. I just think we need a whole different way of looking at the investment strategies that are out there and that continue to be pushed in some direction rather than another. And I read Science Magazine too. I read about the people who get lots and lots and lots of money, and yet they're serial harassers. And whose responsibility is it to stop them? And I will tell you, I feel that it is all of our responsibilities, that it is the responsibility of the departments, it's the responsibility of the full institutions, it's the responsibility of the professional societies. And that's one of the reasons that I'm proud that AAAS was one of the organizations, along with the American Geophysical Union and the AAMC, to stand up the Society's Consortium to try to essentially own our problem as a problem, and to begin to see, is there something that we can begin to do about this? But at the end of the day, unless we stop funding these people, I don't think anything will change. Their bad behavior is being reinforced.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if there's a lab that has its R01 renewed 7 times, securing decades of funding, and yet like just as many students drop out as get their degree.
That's not exactly a good benchmark.
Red flag.
Right.
Yeah.
You got it. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And we have to become much more intentional about the kinds of behaviors that we want to incentivize.
Yeah.
We all want the best science and the best engineering. We want innovation that can address the problems that we have. But we're not going to get that best without really being intentional about the structures that will give us the best. Diversity gives us much better research. But if you're asking people to participate in a structure that has serious defects about the way that you get treated, the impossibility of ever belonging, you know, the fact that you might be exploited, I mean, those things really have to be looked at.
We have a lot of listeners who are in those early stages, the exact people that you're talking about, where we have a much more younger, diverse group. And they may be feeling exactly what you're saying, which is stuck, and that the journey is impossible, and that there is not much that they can do about it. And so I'm asking for a friend. What do you have to say to trainees who are feeling these tensions that we've been discussing? What can they do to feel or to be empowered in this situation?
I think that one of the things that they need to do is to basically step back and say, what is it that I really want, right? And am I getting it in this, by staying in the situation that I'm in? You could ask, for example, to change departments, ask to change mentors, ask to have the opportunity to do some of the things that you know are absolutely critical toward being able to acquire the skills that you're going to need if you want to go to wherever it is that you want to go, all right? And if you can't get it inside, try to see where you might be able to get it outside. And I think about this, you know, like if you're writing a proposal inside, on the one hand is writing a proposal inside. Going and working with a local nonprofit that needs somebody who can write a proposal still gives you experience in writing proposals. May not be the same kinds of proposals, but it at least starts you. It gets you up off of your you know what in order to be able to take control of your life again. I have been advocating for many places to use young investigators, early career people, as reviewers. They are often much more, often have much more experience on the latest techniques and things like this, and can be able to see where there may be alternatives with regard to techniques or whatever. Even if you don't use the reviews in a decision, you can use them to inform the questions that go back. I mean, just try to shake up the system enough that we don't just accept what we have. You said below, I think it, you said earlier, I think it was you, Sally, something about we're part of a system that we did not create, and it was not created with us in mind. And that is absolutely true. You can only really get a hold of that by starting to query that system.
It's so true.
That really resonates. We are nearing the end of our time, so we just want to check in and see, like, is there any messages that you want to make sure that we touch on? Or we can end also with you giving any plug for, like, your Sea Change initiative or anything that you want our audience to leave with or to follow up on.
In addition to Sea Change, there's another effort that we are working on and standing up, something called the STEM Opportunity Alliance, and that's STEM with two M's, mathematics and medicine. And this is an effort to develop a national strategy, a cross-sectoral effort to develop a national strategy to support equity and excellence in STEM. This comes out of a White House summit that was held in December. And it not only talks about what we need from K-12, what we need from colleges and universities, from industry, et cetera, to build the workforce of to people the workforce of the future, but it also talks about what we need from agencies, what we need from funders, what we need people to do. And to the extent that we do need a radical transformation of a system that really does provide opportunity, that I hope that we will begin to explore the kinds of questions that we have raised here today about the extent to which what we is currently in place is what we need to be in place going forward. So I hope that people will go and look at STEM Opportunity Alliance, look at the partners that we have already been able to attract into our work, look at the amount of money that basically that people are committing toward one or another aspect of this total issue. This is a big issue. This is about our being able to address things like climate change, like health disparities, like national security, you know, the kind of the future of where science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and medicine is going to take us. Ethical use of AI, I mean, just on and on and on and on. But if we don't get this right, if we don't get the people part right, if we don't basically understand that this is the resource, these are the assets that we have, and we've got to be very careful in the way that we think about the assets and that we shepherd the assets within the entire system. Are we good stewards or are we not? And I am afraid that right now, when we fail to ask and answer these questions about the fundamental structure of the scientific enterprise, that we're not being good stewards. And so I think that this is a time now for people to basically get on board and start asking, we can do better. And so in the words of John Lewis, we will all go out and get into good trouble.
I think that's the perfect phrase to end this conversation on. That's exactly the kind of empowerment I think our audience is going to appreciate. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your insights with us. I'm really excited about this episode. I think our audience is, I mean, they're feeling it. They're in the trenches. They know all of these things from the other side, you know, so.
So they know that I am not pulling any punches.
That's right. They know.
There's enough blame to go around, including ourselves. Okay. And I want us to stop taking it.
Yeah. Yep. That is true.
Thank you so much, Dr. Malcolm. This interview, like, I feel invigorated just like talking with you about how we can think about these issues going forward. I think it's important for students to know that there are people with power like yourself who are thinking about the systems and who do have the awareness that, you know, it's not just students who know that being a student is hard.
It's not just students. No. You know, and a lot of people, I mean, one of the things that we never talked about, but at some point you may want to talk about, and that is student debt.
We are planning an episode on this.
Graduate school debt. Everybody always talks about undergrad. No, I'm talking about graduate school debt.
Yeah.
And what that does, I mean, it affects your whole life, your ability to ever get a mortgage. I mean, it's like, and for what? I mean, that's why I said you've got to be much more intentional about why you're still sitting there. And if it ain't working for you, basically, you got to say, I'm out of here. Because otherwise, you aren't going to really be able to move forward.
Yeah.
It's like that old boyfriend from high school.
Amazing.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's important for students to hear these messages and to understand that there is an alternate path and it's not a failure. It's just a learning, and you can make your own decision, empower yourself, and go in a different direction. And there's absolutely only good things to come from that.